accept the reality of the world with which we're presented. It's as simple as that.
Billions of people just living out their lives. Oblivious.
They taught you good. Made you believe their world.
You can deny all the things I've seen, all the things I've discovered, but not for much longer. Because too many others know what's happening out there. And no one, no government agency has jurisdiction over the truth.
Hello and welcome to Beyond the Paradigm. I'm your host, Paul Breckell. Welcome back to all my regular listeners who come back week after week. Thank you for tuning in and welcome to any new listeners on this podcast where we discuss many different topics, often considered fringe topics. We've talked about all kinds of things on here, UFOs, giants. We've looked at the COVID pandemic. We've talked about Nephilim bloodlines and all kinds of other topics. I like to have a variety of topics on here and challenge the official narrative. And like I often say on here, you've got to unlearn the lies that you've been taught, because we have all been taught lies. We've been taught lies through the system, what we call the system. You go to school, you find yourself at a desk at 4 years old, and this authority figure is in front of you telling you all kinds of things. And it's to test you to see how much information you retain that's been downloaded to you through the matrix. Obviously, I don't mean a literal matrix, but that's often how we talk about this system that the devil himself has set up to blind the eyes of men. And even our Lord called the devil the god of this world. So it isn't any wonder really that we're just bombarded with lies continually through the mainstream media, through the education system. And hopefully just through independent podcasts like this, we can begin to sort of re-educate ourselves, unlearn those lies we've been taught and re-educate ourselves. I try to bring on interesting guests who talk about all kinds of different topics and have done massive amounts of research. And our returning guest today, Gary Wayne, is a favourite on here. His previous episode that I did with him has been extremely popular. If you've not listened to that one, I'd probably go back, listen to the episode that I did previously with Gary Wayne entitled Nephilim Bloodlines and Freemasonry, and then come and tune into this episode, this second one with Gary. What I wanted to do is just tell people that there is ways you can get hold of me and connect with me. I've also recently just gone back on Facebook, so I have the Twitter account, what I tell people about, Paradigm_79, and Instagram, Paradigm1979, but I've got a page on Facebook. I did start it a while ago, but I wasn't, my wife was managing it, and I was sending her little bits to put on there, but I've gone back on Facebook myself. I was off it for a number of years due to security reasons for a previous job that I had. I was a prison officer, and I thought it best that I came off all these social media sites. So, but I've gone back on there now, and I'm looking after the page myself, Beyond the Paradigm, and I'll be posting things on there. So you can follow me on there if you'd want to connect with me that way. And you can also email me with any suggestions of topics or guests that you'd like on here at beyondtheparadigm@yahoo.com. So like I said, today I've got Gary Wayne on. He is an extremely knowledgeable person. When I'm talking to him, my head's in a bit of a spin sometimes with all the information that's coming at me. And the them type of episodes where you need to listen to them again. And obviously, because I do this podcast, I speak to them initially and I listen to all the information, and then I go back and edit it. So I'm listening to it again. And it's often through that second time of re-listening to what I've been talking about with the person that I pick up some information that sometimes I miss, because a lot of the time there's a lot of information coming at me and I'm seeking to also get through some questions and hopefully get the best interview that I can for you guys out there who tune in week after week. So I just hope you're all enjoying it. I can see the numbers going up every week, so it's really encouraging. So that's enough talk from me. I'm going to go and bring Gary onto the show. Well, it's a pleasure to have you back on the show, Gary. Welcome again for the second time.
Yeah, well, thank you for inviting me back, and so happy to be back with you and talking more about some of the topics that I think I'd like to see. I might be biased, but I would like to think people take a closer look at, because kind of fills in a lot of the blanks to the questions that people have in the world.
Oh, definitely. I mean, like I said to you, you know, I've been looking through the sections of your book, and like we talked last time, there's some fascinating topics in there. And obviously, a podcast episode can't do justice to years of research. But like last time, we had the episode there, and it was cut a little short, really, obviously, because of technical issues, unfortunately. So there was a couple of things that I wanted to sort of follow up with regarding the last episode, and then obviously I want to talk to you about your new book that's just come out. We'll get talking about that. So we were talking about obviously secret societies and talked about Freemasonry. And yeah, obviously another secret society which a lot of people will have heard of is the Knights Templar. But Templar historians noted that the order was opportunistically created as a ruse to protect Christian pilgrims as they journeyed to Jerusalem. So what was the real reason for the Templars, and like, you know, why were they actually created, and how is that linked to Freemasonry?
Yeah, all good questions, and not small questions, as most things that we talk about lead into a lot of different directions. So they needed to create an organization that was a superficial sort of front, and that they could do things in behind the scenes with a little more privacy. And so this is not unusual in secret societies. So, for example, with Freemasonry, you have the lower level initiates. And so unless you're third degree on the York Rite or 33rd degree on the Scottish Rite, you're just there for window dressing as you're starting to learn, and maybe you will become first level adept or not. And that they're out there doing things in the public way that keeps people sort of giving them a good look within the community. They get the initiates get to mingle amongst each others. And in the meantime, the adepts behind the scenes are working at their agenda. So it's a standard MO deployed by secret societies to work this way. So they'll have multiple levels, which will kind of confuse people. So even like the Rosicrucians, for example, they have three different levels within their society. So one actually plays to people who may not actually be at an adept level, even though they're much higher than an adept in a Freemasonic organization. So just so that people understand kind of the complexities. So this is at work with the Knights Templar. And most people think that the Knights Templar were these poor monks. There were two Cistercian monks amongst the original 10 or the original 9. Even though the Templar records and Rex Deus records will show there's 11 members, two were silent members, but still a small group. But only two were Cistercians. And Cistercians were the group of monks that worked as moles within the Roman Church, as Gnostic moles, and are the ones that are going to provide cover for this new organization. And Saint Bernard is also a Cistercian monk and a Benedictine monk, basically the same term there, different kind of branches at times, but they're the same monastic order, is actually going to speak and carry the day to ensure in 1128 the Knights Templar get a papal bull. And so you have two of those monks. The rest are all bloodline, probably for the most part, first son scions in the royal bloodlines, as and the three most prominent ones are Anjou, de Bouillon, and de Payon. And even the monks, they're related in blood to the members of the Knights Templar, the two Cistercian monks, because one needs to remember, and I don't remember whether we covered this in the first show or not, that they controlled the religious organization, the large oligarchical business organizations. They controlled the army. They controlled the justice system. They controlled the governorships through the kings and the queens. And so they populated their bloodlines. They would be lower level, perhaps, on as siblings, as, you know, in order of what you're born, where your agenda is going to be assigned. And many of them participate in the Roman Church and part of the black nobility of popes that get appointed, and why you have so many anti-popes that are also in the church, because you have rival kings going back and forth to try and take down the elected pope and replace it with their own pope. So kind of the intrigue that sort of goes along with the Roman church, and it's all mostly coming from the influence of the bloodlines and through their bloodline members within the Gnostic monastic orders. So they're there for their own purposes and not Christian purposes. And let's also venture in here that De Payan, De Bouillon, and this particular branch of Anjou are all from the Lorraine region of France, as opposed to the Anjou that would be in with the Naples royal bloodline and throne, or the Hungarian Anjou, or the Sicilian, not the Sicilian, the Anjou that's in, I think it's Crete, where they come from, Crete or Malta, one of those islands. So there's several different branches of the Anjou, which is going to interplay downstream in what they set up as the Kingdom of Heaven in Jerusalem. So they're there to do a few things in particular. One is to try and lead the Templars and the Crusades to get Jerusalem back, which is De Bouillon's role, and he meets with some collaborating monks before, which are also Gnostic and work closely with the Cistercians, and they're the monks that show up with him and start setting up the priories and everything in the Middle East. And so once he's crowned, or they take the city of Jerusalem, he's crowned the first king of Jerusalem, although technically he doesn't take the king title, but his brother Baldwin the first will. And Baldwin the second is the one that's going to be crowned in 1118 on a small priory on the Rock of Zion, as the first king of Jerusalem, again through bloodline connections, because these three, the Anjou, De Payan, and De Bouillon, and by the way, De Payan is going to become the Grand Master of the Junior Order, from the Senior Order that originally set it up from these bloodline first scions as the prior of Sion. 1118, you get the official establishment in 1118, not only of the King of Jerusalem, not only the title, but the junior order being led by the Payan as the first Grand Master. And so the bloodlines of these three that we were just talking about, De Payan, De Bouillon, and Anjou, they take their descendancy back to the last royal bloodline acknowledged member of the Merovingians, and so Dagobert, and so they have this bloodline that goes back to multiple scioning of giant bloodlines, and within that they have the King of Jerusalem title, as they believe is their inheritance through scioning in through Benjamites and through very, and I walk through it in a book, several different avenues of grafting that in. The rights to the city of Jerusalem, because in the time of the Exodus, Joshua awards the Benjamites the city of Jerusalem. And so they've got King Saul's bloodline, and they've got other Benjamites that say that they should be the King of Jerusalem, which is one of their goals to get as a title for their grand monarch when they're ready to introduce their dragon Messiah for the end time. It wants that title. And so part of the rivals for dragon messiahs or antichrist type figures is to have this title. And there's three rivals to it within the Anjou today, but King Philippe of Spain, Philippe Bourbon of Spain, has inherited the King of Jerusalem title from his father, Juan Carlos, which I trace through the book some of how that bloodline passes down, and I revisit that in a more detailed way in book two. But there's going to be a lot of rivals. So that's the first thing that they want, is they want to set up their kingdom of heaven and their bloodline, positioning themselves for the end time that they're going to try and bring about. And it's a long-term plan, obviously. But the Knights Templar, their plan is to bring about a universal religion, a universal world government, and, of course, one of their bloodlines on the throne of the world. So they're planning this for a very long time. Now, the second thing that they're there for is to get privacy to excavate under Jerusalem. And what they say they find and what the mythos say they find, it's kind of wide and varied, but some things that we know that they brought back was the building knowledge that was used to build the first temple. And that's the Dionysian builder knowledge passed down from King Hiram to Hiram Abiff. And they trained masons in Jerusalem at the time of King Solomon to build the first temple. And they inherited that building knowledge from the Dionysian builders, who inherited it from the knowledge of Enoch and the Pythagoras mystery schools and the ones that predated it, but were guardians of that knowledge coming down, that survived the flood, that in their mythos, Hermes, one of the Trismegistus, finds this knowledge under the pyramids in nine vaults stacked on top of each other and 36,525 books. And he takes this knowledge back to Nimrod. And they start building Babel City and Babel Tower with this knowledge, which is sort of the Gnostic or the secret society nexus point of where that knowledge first gets reused again after the flood. And then it's passed down through the mystery schools and through the Dionysian builders. So that's the knowledge they bring back. They start building the Gothic churches. It's revolutionary architecture and it's engineering with the flying buttresses and the light and the windows that they can put in there. And then, of course, they decorate it with all polytheist sort of figures because they control the Mason guilds, the Templars do after. They get control of that afterwards. And so these are all dedicated to Mary, but not Mary, mother of Jesus, generally Mary Magdalene as their bloodline and grafting in of Jesus and Mary Magdalene's bloodline in through the same Merovingian bloodlines, all that I cover off in book one. So they also find other knowledge, and some people think it's the Ark of the Covenant. Some people think it was great treasures. Others think there was additional knowledge that was there. And I also think they found bloodline genealogies that they were interested in coming out of Judea and the Southern Kingdom, ones that they may have been missing or ones that they wanted to help verify their pedigrees with. And I think all of that comes back, and that at the time of the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple in 70 AD by the Romans, the Sadducees and Pharisees were not in control of the temple at that time. It was the Essenes. And the Essenes take their religion back to Heliopolis. And they're polytheists. And I think at the time of the monarchy, the religion that Moses originally brought back, which was polytheism, the religion of Egypt, in their view, and that was the original religion of Moses. And in the time of the monarchy, it went rogue into monotheism to create a larger mythos for the monarchy. I think differently as a Christian, but I understand that's their belief system, and we need to understand what they believe because it's sort of behind all of the motivations of the things that they manifest in this world. So they're looking for, knowledge of these bloodlines and things that are going to help them in their preparation for this large conspiracy that they're trying to bring about. So whether or not there was the Ark of the Covenant there, the Holy Grail, we don't know. Most of this knowledge is brought back to Europe. The knowledge that they get is taken to locations within the monastic orders of the Benedictines and Cistercians, overseen by Saint Bernard, who decode and translate this knowledge, and they start utilizing it and spreading it around to the various organizations that they have. So that's the biggest thing, I think, was to get that knowledge, whatever it was, and then take it back to France. And some of it made it to Rosalind Castle as well. And then, as the mythos goes, some of it went over to Oak Island, as they needed to find more and more places. And as a member of the Knights Templar in Canada, as I watched an interview on him, or several interviews on him, said that they didn't leave it at Oak Island. So all of those television shows on the History Channel about Oak Island, they're going to find little dribs and drabs, but they moved it again, and they were influential in, I know I'm down a rabbit hole here, I'll come back out quickly. As agreements were made to set up the reserves with the First Nations in North America, they went in behind and set up agreements to store this knowledge and treasure in various locations on First Nation reserves around North America. That was his story anyways, and that's why they're never going to find anything at, you know, digging at Oak Island, but it makes for fascinating television. Now what's important to the Knights Templar is they're the first modern secret society organization that we would recognize today, where it was all sort of at the bloodline level. This is going to be the one that is going to be almost this major central organization. So when they fall in 1307, they're going to rebuild those lower levels, but not have it all centralized.
So do you think they're active today? Like, do you think there's sort of a Templar type society that's operating even more secretly than what they used to?
Oh, sure. So, you know, 1188 at the cutting of the Elm, and that's a year after the fall of Jerusalem, the Priory of Sion. And by the way, I do cover them in book one, but after I published the book, I realized there was this whole furor about whether they actually existed or not. So I put the documentation into book two so that we can track that properly. Just so that, you know, everybody says, well, you know, if you can't back some of these things up, I thought I gave enough, but apparently we need some more. So anyways, just to settle that in book two. As it ties into some of the what I didn't cover in book one with the secret societies. So when we look at the fall of the Knights Templar in 1307, they weren't protected by this larger Priory of Sion order, because at the cutting of the element, Geezer's castle, by the way, which is the same castle that their grand monarch that they want to present as the Dragon Messiah in the end time will first pass through the arch on the main street and then start to ascend. It'll be some sort of occult ritual, but then we'll start as ascendancy to Antichrist if they get their way of being the one, because there can only be one, as in the Highlander movie. So if they actually went out on that. So you have the splitting of the Elm, which is where they leave, and then afterwards they start to create what they call a Rosicrucian order, order of the Red Cross, just as the Knight Templars also had the Red Cross, which is an ancient order that I also cover off in book one. And that we start to see them in 1323 in Scotland with Robert the Bruce, who was excommunicated by the Catholic Pope for killing his rival in a Catholic church. I don't know why they were so upset about that, just tongue in cheek, but they were, and they excommunicated him. So he offered protection to some of the escaping Templars who set up through the St. Clairs. St. Clair, as it's transliterated in, and the battle partner of Hugh de Payon was a Henry St. Clair, descendant of the Sinclairs who founded Freemasonry for these fleeing Knights Templar. And also they provided, I think they provided protection for Robert the Bruce and helped them win the Scottish independence. And then 1323 creates the Rosicrucian Society, the Red Cross Order of Royals. And it's going to have, over time, it's going to move down to be just the invisible 33 that are going to be around in the time at this period, starting in about 1317, we get a documentation of the 33, the invisible ones. They're going to create below them as this new organization starts to expand because the Templars have fallen. The Committee of 300 families. So the Council of 33, the 33 invisible ones. And below that is the Committee of 300 families, and then the lower Rosicrucian order. So as you get the Grand Master list in the Priory of Sion, you start to see a transition away from the royal bloodlines like the St. Clairs that I provide in book one, and you get the elite educated class, whether it's Da Vinci and Newton and people like that. So that's representing that separation down in that order. So in when we look at that sort of junior and senior order, it was the senior order that got upset at the junior order, and that they started to rebuild these organizations after the flood. So, I mean, after the fall of the Knights Templar. So you have the Freemasons by the Sinclairs. You have the Rosicrucian Order, which is going to be above Freemasonry, and they're going to create, starting in about the 1500s, with its real roots, and within the time of Galileo, they're going to restart that in Germany because of the persecution by the Roman Church that drove the elites underground, and then you see the Illuminati start up again. So the Illuminati has a specific agenda, just as the Rosicrucians do, and they're all part of this, what I call, as they talk about in book two, the Thelemic tree of these trunk orders. So Freemasonry at the bottom, Illuminati, second level up, third level is the Rosicrucians at the top half, top 50% of the Rosicrucians, from my understanding, are all pure blood. So you have rising adepts of lesser bloods through Freemasonry, Illuminati, and then those who are worthy will go into the Rosicrucians, where it starts intersecting with the pure blood orders, which are, again, as we talked about, the Committee of 300 above that. And then you have the Council of 33, and then you have the 13 families. And then in these trunk organizations, you have all of these branch organizations coming in with a central sort of, each branch has a hierarchical order, almost like a pyramid. So, and then everything that branches out of that core intersection organization are, is part of the whole hierarchy in different branches of what they oversee. Envision it as a evergreen tree, specifically the evergreen tree on Mount Hermon, the cedar, and their genealogical tree as the elm tree. As the elms is used at the cutting of the elms, or an ash tree, which is kind of in at that time kind of considered the same, and in some versions an oak tree, and oaks are also an ash, and elms are also talked in terms of the groves on Mount Hermon, but ash, but oak particularly, with the Tuatha De Danann or the Dittanu, or the various names that go along with the Sidae, Shea, however you want to pronounce the different tribes of those peoples. So yes, they are the modern secret society that shows all the ones that we see today. So if you're looking, let's say, at the CFR and say, well, where do they fit in? They don't fit in on the trunk. They fit in intersecting into the Committee of 300. CFR, no, into the Illuminati, sorry. If you're looking at the IMF or the Bilderbergers or the Davos crew or the Club of 300, put them into the Committee of 300. The Jesuits, and I document this in book two, which I don't cover in book one because I didn't want to get it too, took book one too sidetracked on that. I know a lot of people link the Jesuits are at the top of the order. They're not. They just branch in. And they're going to branch in either to the Committee of 300 or to the Council of 33. They're sponsored by the Black Nobility, which you can say is, some people say is strictly Italy, and some people say, well, no, the Black Nobility is also the Rex Dais families or the Royals of Western Europe as well. It's probably a little bit of both. And then there's two levels of Black Nobility, so you have to be careful with that as well. But the Jesuits were created and report into the Black Nobility. So depending on which level of Black Nobility you're having them report into is where they'll fit in on the Thelemic tree, that they call it. And so in after the fall of the Templars in 1317, the Invisible 33, they try and get the Templar organization reset up. The Pope says, yes, but I'm going to control it. And so they poison the Pope and then they have to go undercover. And the Pope never really sets up the new Templars. So they're waiting for an opportunity to get back into the Roman Church. And that's where they get the opportunity with Ignatius of Loyola through a Black Nobility bloodline member of the Borgia family, Francis Borgia, who is a bask in at the in the order in the court of the King of Spain at that time, and they're going to work together on this. And so Borgia is the Grand Master of the Montesa Order, which is interesting because the Montesa Order was created in 1317 after the fall of the Knights Templar to get a hold of Templar assets in Spain, and so the Roman Church doesn't get them. And so, you know, a few hundred years later in the 1500s, you've got Francis Borgia, first Grand Master of, not first Grand Master of the Montesa Order, but a Grand Master Order, and he's going to fund Ignatius of Loyola. And this is going to start the creation of the Jesuits that they call within the secret societies the New Templar Order. And they're going to reinstate their goals. And by 1565, Francis Borgia is the third Grand Master of the Jesuits. And they succeed shortly thereafter to get control of the banking arm of the Vatican Bank and move that to Switzerland, where most of the cash went to Switzerland from the fall of the Knights Templar in 1307 into the hands of the Knights Hospitaller, which is a sister organization with a white cross. And that's where the start of the modern banking comes from and why you have the white cross on the Swiss flag. And then the Rothschilds were created after the fall of the Templars to have banking control outside the Roman Church. And they kept their headquarters, even though they were funded as the Bauer family and funded by the Masonic orders and the royal bloodlines into the position that they were. They didn't change their name until they set up the London Bank in about 1810 to 1812, and they changed it to Rothschilds at that point in time. And they didn't move their money completely to Switzerland. I'm sure they had a bunch of it there until I think the 90s of the 1900s. And so now you have all of the major banking, because Borgia moved the banking to Switzerland along with all of the other money. And that's where all the off the books money is kept. And if people think Elon Musk or Bill Gates or Bezos or the names that are thrown around that they are the richest people in the world, not even close. The money that's kept in Switzerland, highly protected and off the books, is extraordinary. And when I was doing the research for book one in the early 2000s, at that time, they estimated from people that I talked to from 300 trillion to 500 trillion. You can only imagine what that would be today.
If that was cash, you'd be looking at truckloads of money.
Yeah,
it's outrageous.
Yeah, I have no idea how many trucks it would take. Sure it'd be incredible, but
well, it's like you're saying that, like, you know, Bezos and all these people, they're not the richest people in the world, because obviously they have these rich lists that come out. But like the Rothschilds, for example, they're never on there. They're never on there because they're way richer than anyone on there.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know,
and so when they talk about through the Davos crew or puppets like Biden, the great reset that they want to bring about, because they want to take all your land away to pay for that, so that you go back to the old four class and feudal system and destroy the middle class, so you can be maybe entrepreneurial if you're lucky and permitted to be a baker or a tailor, but you're never going to run the larger businesses and the rest is the slave class. So when they want to do the great reset, they're going to take the assets of the people who don't have debts to pay for partial of what they're doing. And then you're not going to be allowed to own anything. So you're going to be renting, as what has been done through history. But those oligarchs who are trying to intermarry and move up through the generations with their children. So the ones, let's say, like Gates and the Clintons who go to the Bilderberger meetings that are at the lower level that meet with the royals and get their marching orders every year. And the same thing happens at the Davos meeting. They invite you in, you get your marching orders, but you're not the one calling the shots. You know, you have, I lost my train of thought there for a second. So, these, I'm trying to bring that back. We were just talking about, I think, the level of the money. Oh, yeah. So these ones that are invited in, what they're told is through this great reset. Because if you're Bezos or Elon Musk, you're saying, I don't want to lose all my money. Right. What? Why would I go along with that? What they've promised them, from what I understood, and it's hard to get much information on this, but as the whole reset plan goes, is that this hidden money comes out after the Great Reset, or part of it anyways, and then they fund all of these cooperative billionaires, trillionaires, to go back into business. So they're going to be the few elect oligarchs around the world. So when we look at the oligarchs of Russia or the oligarchs of China, that's the Babylon system that they want to set up in the end time. That makes the way for what they call the Leviathan system. Both the Babylon system is the occult term, and then inherited by the Leviathan system by Antichrist in the end time, when that multi-headed Leviathan or Hydra monster comes up out of the Sea of Nations to establish the first 10 kings, and then at the midpoint, Antichrist taking that over. And so that's what they're trying to set up, is that whole Babylon system, where in Revelation 18, it talks about the great and mighty men and the wealthy around the world, and Babylon controls all of the trade and everything, and all the nobility and the merchants grow rich through Babylon. That's the system. That's the oligarch system. And that's what they would like to set up as part of the Great Reset. But of course, nothing ever happens on schedule, or at least their schedule. So they continually are frustrated, but eventually it'll come about, I think.
Yeah. That was actually my last question. I'm going to talk to you about that. We'll carry on with that train of thought. So I read a little bit on your website, and you've put End Time Babylon will become a worldwide organization that will reach beyond religion. Babylon will control global politics and commerce, all the while growing opulent through its enterprises. End Time Babylon's grip will squeeze its great riches, tribute from every person and organization in the world through its imposed, enforced, and futuristic commercial beast system. How close do you think we are to that? Because obviously, I mean, we've got this talk of these CBDCs, and, you know, there's obviously Elon Musk, we've mentioned him, he's got the neural link and all this. And, yeah. And obviously, we know in Revelation, it talks about this mark of the beast, that if you don't receive it, you will not be able to buy or sell anything. So through your research and that, what, I mean, I'm not asking you to give us a date, but do you think, like, we're looking at, we're on the way to that, aren't we now? I don't think there's any other time in history where you could have foreseen this. Like, I mean, 100 years ago, there wasn't that technology, was there?
So no, there wasn't, but there was at some time before, because nothing is new under the sun, and what was will be again. So it's that angelic technology that took place before the flood that would have destroyed the whole world through violence, technology, and other corruptions. This is what we're starting to see come about now, and it's angelic technology that they're trying to redevelop. And so I think we're a ways away. I know at the Davos meeting in January, they put a re-emphasis on AI, because it's not where they need it to be part of this implementation of the beast system. They pushed back the introduction as cryptocurrency, as Federal Reserve and Reserve Bank sponsored around the world, which was supposed to happen late last year or this year, because again, the technology is not quite there. So even with the hyperlink that Elon Musk is talking about at the Davos meeting, they were talking about this type of thing, is that you're going to have these links that you will be almost like a counterfeit telepathy, where you can just mentally connect with people through this link and this chip that they want to introduce, primarily through the healthcare system, which where the demand will come from the pestilences that they'll create to implement it. So they're saying they're 10 years away from that. And so they're doubling down because the technology has not been able to merge the developing technologies in separate lanes. So to get a interdimensional currency system, you need that cryptocurrency. So that's developing, and that's the quantum computing and quantum mechanics level. And the invisible algorithms that they can control behind, that's developing nicely. And they call them daemons, of course, demons that you can't see, invisible ones that control the true agenda. And that they're going to need to put in additional technology that can't be cracked, so that their invisible money never gets exposed or ever gets taken. And so this cryptocurrency is designed to work in this new system in multiple dimensions. AI was developed to search in multiple locations and in multiple dimensions, along with the quantum computing. Well, that's why you have that linkage of that technology at CERN. But AI is still not there. It's the key to all of this, because as they're talking about with the cashless society, let's call it electronic money, and the control aspect that it's going to have with it, and the ability to work in multiple dimensions, it's a level that is just sort of unimaginable that they're working towards, that they want to bring about. So the only way to get this done is they have to get the AI developed in a lot more ever increasing manner. And even Elon Musk is jumping into AI development. So he was on the record saying Google was the evil AI. So my response is to that is, I will create good AI. It's all the same agenda. White hat, black hat, doesn't really matter. But this is a system that needs to come together, and it's just not there yet, but it will come together. And it, you know, includes digital medicine that they're trying to introduce. So with the pestilence, you had digital message type of base technology with mRNA vaccines that they're going to want to be able to dispense completely digitally through the message technology through the chip or the implant. So all of that is still in its development. And part of that is they have to be able to offer immortality in the physical world. So we see other technologies developing, clones, transhumanism. So they're on their way for that. And the ability to create parts for people, I guess, would be part of the clone technology, 3D printing, all of that sort of levels. And they would have to also supply unlimited knowledge, which is the Atman particle that I don't know whether they found yet or not. It's spelled ATMA or ATMAN. People in the New Age would be more familiar with it as the divine essence. And what it is this particle that's in every dimension, but it's invisible. And so what it does is it merges with a particle one could measure at the quantum level. And they're looking for this because this is what contains all of the knowledge in all dimensions of the metaverse. And so, as they like to call it, and that through quantum entanglement, it would dispense all of that knowledge instantaneously. And that's what they want this chip system, this beast system, to tap into. And it also sort of starts to intersect with some religious things in terms of the divine essence is sort of understood as Sophia in the Western Gnosticism, as the goddess of wisdom, the mother goddess who created the 12 archons that Satan, in what they would say the god of the Bible, was part of, who went rogue in their belief system. And this is the philosophy of the world, the love of Sophia, that there's their theology behind the seven sciences that created the secret societies through the mystery schools, mysticism that, you know, was created to protect the seven sciences before the flood. So the divine essence is like the Brahman in the Hindus and in the Vedas, where the Atman terminology comes from, and the divine essence. So it's like yoga when you're trying to get in contact with that divine essence. You're opening up portals, and you're either letting spirits in or you're astral planing to go meet with these invisible ones as that goes. This would be a technological link to that and the knowledge, but give you access from the divine essence. Creating a mother goddess, creating a Sophia type of being in polytheism is a counterfeiting of the Holy Spirit. It is a sin or a blasphemy against the Holy Spirit, which is the only sin that's not forgiven. And so it's part of the mark. So it's part of what's coming. So Babylon also controls all of the nations, as it said in Revelation 18:23. And that word is controlled through either magic spells or sorceries, depending on which translation that you're reading in Revelation 18:23. And so that's the Greek word pharmakia. It has two other Greek words, pharmakous, pharmakos, as it's used in the New Testament, which is the root for pharmaceuticals and the suppliers of vaccines. And that she's going to seduce the world and control it through that. It's part of the whole beast system and the implant system that the Davos crew says they're going to introduce the chip system through the healthcare system as the delivery system, through contrived catastrophes that they're going to bring about. It's diabolical, right? It's, you know, Diabolos. It's, that's where diabolical takes its root from, is Diabolos for the devil. It is that system that Antichrist will inherit and then take to another level. So I think we're going to see multiple attempts to get this in, and it's going to be difficult because it's that complex. And so we're going to see it develop in pieces. So we have to remember that even though I'm not a fan of any of that technology, it's not until the mark of the beast is until somebody would cross over that line where it would be a sin not forgiven. So, but that system will be well in place, just as we see those technologies being developed before Antichrist shows up.
The mark of the beast is one of those things that people obviously talk about. Well, what is it? Is it a physical mark? Is it a spiritual mark? And I see all these videos.
Yeah,
I would say that it's both. Because it doesn't have to be A or B. It can be A and B.
Yeah.
People always like want to fall on one side or another, yep. But I see that there's going to be a spiritual aspect to it as well as the physical aspect. I mean, I'm not going to say what I think it is because I don't know exactly, but I just
still
believe
developing.
There's a physical. Yeah.
I agree with you on this, by the way. It's both.
Yeah, absolutely. I just don't understand why people always seem to think it has to be one or on a lot of issues. It's got to be this or it's got to be that. Like, yeah. You know, you've got to be pro-Israel.
Yeah.
Or if you're not, that means you support Hamas. Well, no, yes. It doesn't.
Yep.
You know what I mean? It can, I take that line of thinking with a lot of things that it can be both. I've lost my train of thought now. Oh, that was. So. In your second book, which has just come out, Genesis 6 Conspiracy Part 2, How Understanding Prehistory and Giants Helped Define End Time Prophecy. So in chapter 5 of your book, entitled The Serpent's Root, you wrote, if giants were indeed recreated after the flood, they too were produced by another group of rebellious seraphim as the post-diluvian serpent seed for the Rephaim giant and the house of dragon. What differentiates the Rephaim from the Nephilim, if anything, and what's the house of dragon?
So in antiquity, dragon was understood as the same type of creature beings at different levels of beings as serpents and crocodiles. So a seraphim angel is a six-winged serpent-faced angel watcher, the sons of God who created most of the giants. And I'll talk about possibilities of other watchers creating giants as book two unfolds. And they would have created serpentine offspring, spurious offspring that would have looked like them, both before and after the flood. And if you have a cherubim that's creating offspring, it would do the same thing. So this is the House of Dragon. This is the bloodlines of the dragon bloodlines, and the allegory for the matriarchal bloodlines are dragon and raven, and for the matriarchal bloodline is fairy and owl. And so as when you're understanding their allegories, they're talked in those sort of terms. So that House of Dragon is the house of the various royales, both before and after the flood. And royale, I look at in book two as defining for people, is the same term as Rex Deus, which means kings of God. Just as royale goes back to Old French roi, and it goes back to regal and rule, and through Latin and through Indo-Aryan. And AL is a transliteration of EL, which means a god or an angel or a fallen angel, in Hebrew. And just as you have Baal, meaning Lord God, is AL is part of the transliteration. So you'll see EL transliterated as AL in other languages, as IL, ILU, and several other types of transliterations, but it's talking about the same group of these beings. And so these are the ones that take their lineage back to a specific gens of a specific bloodline of giant, and then back to a specific celestial mafia godfather. And so it's important to understand when we see all this imagery and of the House of Dragon, that's not just fiction. It goes back to that sort of physical imagery. So if you go back into prehistory, what were most of the gods described as? Dragons and serpents. So you have like the dragon creator gods in China. You have the feathered serpents and plumed serpents in the Quiche Maya and all the Central American and First Nation peoples. And you have, the Nagas in India. I won't go through the whole, but serpentine imagery was all through the ancient color cultures around the Middle East as well. And their offspring, the original kings and generations thereafter, were described as serpents as well. Why? Because they looked like them. And so it's part of the imagery of heraldry, where you have the dragon as part of that imagery. That's there for a reason. It's part of the taciturn language that goes back to the specific angelic beings that they come from, in their coat of arms. And so you have this group of angels after the flood that are known as offspring gods in polytheism, and they take over for the parent gods before the flood. So they also inherit the mythos of the parent gods, and they also say that they kill the parent gods, which seems to be more allegory because you can't kill an immortal being. It's just not possible. Allegory for how they make them disappear. And I don't think they killed them. I think the parent gods went to the pit prison for the crimes that they did against humanity, and crimes against the Holy Spirit, and crimes against creation. And they went to the pit prison. So the rebellious angels have a counterfeit organizational structure similar to the loyal angels, and it's called the host of heaven, which is the Hebrew word saba, which means an army of angels, which implies rank and order. So I also go through the angelic structure of those orders that were presented biblically in book two as well. And so if those original angels before the flood were thrown into the pit prison, then they would move up into the council of gods that's talked about in Psalms 82, and ruling over the 70 nations, both before and after the flood. And as counted by 70 nations through the Table of Nations in Genesis, Standard First Chronicles, or Exodus 1:5, by the number of the nations or sons of Israel born in Egypt, which was 70. So you have a constant number of nations both before and after the flood, and likely into the future, into the millennium. And so they moved up to take over this. And we have this Council of the Baalim, because the Baalim link over to the Bible, or the Council of Nippur, both before and after the flood. All the polytheist cultures have a mountain and a assembly of the gods. The Ugaritics also have the Baalim and the assembly of the Datanu, or the Datanu, depending on how you want to pronounce that, of giants and royales. Now, what's interesting is that in the Ugaritic text, Baal and Ashtaroth, or Baal and Anat, were the ones who created the Rapiu, RPM, transliterated Rapiu, Rapium in different transliterations into English, which is the vowelless Semitic root for Rephaim after the flood. And they're doing fertility rituals to bring them back, because they've disappeared for some reason. There's no explanation, but they're trying to bring them back because they have a fertility issue. And they're trying to create more giants. And so the Raphaim seem to be post-diluvian giants. And the Nephilim, biblically, seem to be the antediluvian giants. And Nephilim only shows up three times in the Old Testament as a Hebrew word, once in Genesis 6:4 for the creation of those giants, and then twice in Numbers 13:33 when it's talking about the Anak as the children of giants. Giants is used twice in that verse, and that goes back to Nephilim as well. That's the only time after the flood you get the term Nephilim used. And it's not that it doesn't mean giants, because it means giants as in, you know, something huge. And I walked through all of this in book one or book two, just to give people who need the arguments for people who say they weren't really giants. I give you so much information on that, that might be worth having that just for that part of the argument. Also, they also rely that they are tyrants or bullies. Well, I also cover off in book two is that you'd link that back to Tyrannos of the Gyges, or the Gyes, and the root word for Gyges coming out of Greek for giants. These were Herculides and or Gyges or Gog bloodlines from the gods, which are the royals after the flood. And they're also called bulls, just as the fallen angels were called bulls, and their offspring were also called bulls. And I cover that off in book two. So when they're talking about the Nephilim in Numbers 13:33, this is part of what they call the evil report, or the embellished part of the report, when the scouts are describing what they saw in the land of the covenant. And so they say the Anakim in Hebrew are Nephilim, which is not true. Nephilim, in my supposition, are post or antediluvian giants. And it doesn't mean that Caleb and Joshua didn't give accurate details. They did. They just didn't call them Nephilim. And it doesn't mean that the Anakim aren't giants, because in Deuteronomy 2, where we get some of the giant nations that are talked about, like the Anakim or the Emim or the Horim or the Avim, goes back to the Hebrew word giant, or I mean the English word giant, which goes back to the Hebrew word rapha as a singular, Raphaim as its plural, as giants. And by inference and putting information together, they're not as big as the Nephilim. So the people who are, and they're post-diluvian giants, and the reason why the scouts who do not want to go on the land and take on these monsters are using Nephilim is because they know they're larger and even more scarier and even more powerful. Otherwise, they would just say Rephaim, like they're trying to take them. So that has two things that are inferred, that they understood Rephaim as giants, but they wanted to scare the people that they were like the Nephilim giants, which provides the veracity as well in that inference that they existed and they're even more terrible than the terrible ones. And the terrible ones show up in Ezekiel 32 as the terrible ones, and that's the Hebrew word arit. And if you take that with its plural It would be Eretim for ones. And it means just as Nephilim are the giant ones or the serpentine giant ones, however you want to. And so it's the male plural, but it also is denoted not only as plural, but plural after something. And so Eret is the root word, part of the root word or the compound word of Ugarit. And that's interesting that you've got these Rephaim terrible ones talking to a terrible one as a Rephaim giant in Ezekiel 32. And I cover this off in book two as well. To the terrible ones who were slain for doing terrible things on the earth, and they're in the sides of the pit prison, which would include Nephilim and terrible ones. And they list some of these terrible ones like the Assyrian and other ones, the Tyrus, as you go through Ezekiel 32. And they're there after they were killed, as because they're part of the terrible ones. And they're also talking to the mighty in there, which is El. So you have the gods in there, and you have their spurious offspring as the terrible ones that are in there. And these are the terrible ones that go back to the Hebrew word Erech, which is part of the Ugarit, as in the Ugaritic text or Ugarit city. And the first compound of the two words in there is Ug, which I take back to show that it's King Og, as you have OWG going back to UWG in Hebrew. And this is the city of Og, the terrible one, who is going to be the giant that is going to be leading his 60-city Pentapolis in part of the Eastern campaign, along with King Sihon, who has 35 to 40 cities. So, 7 to 8 Pentapolis that Israel is going to take on east of the Jordan River. And so Og is mentioned isn't mentioned specifically in the Ugaritic text, but technically he is by his name on the city. But the Rephaim, they are mentioned as part of the assembly of the Tatanu, and they're doing these fertility rituals. And the Baalim is located on Mount Hermon, and they're ruling from Ashtaroth and Edrei, which was the city of King Og during the time of the Exodus. So I think after the War of Giants in Genesis 14, he moves over there and takes over when most of the Rephaim tribe is destroyed. There are other tribes, and he's going to rule over the Amorites after that. So Rephaim, look at them as post-Diluvian giants. You get their term Rephaim or Rapha as translated as giant 25 times in Hebrew in the Old Testament. So the only other time giant is translated into English in Job 16 as a giant, that word goes back to Gibor or Gibberim, the term used to describe the giants, and whether that's actually a giant or just a mighty warrior, I'll leave for that for people to decide whether it is. But Gibor can also be used to just describe a strong person or a warrior, like David's mighty men. Goes back to Gibor. It can also be used for strength and the power of God, or also to use to describe angels, as it's used 158 times in the Old Testament. Not always for a giant, is my point. And so all of this sort of leads us towards this understanding that the Rephaim are distinct from the Nephilim. And by that report in Numbers 13:33, probably smaller and less gifted. And so it's the Rephaim that I'm going to deal mostly with in book two and the associated tribes.
Yeah, because we talk about giants a lot, like we say giants, but there's obviously different tribes. I mean, I've been looking I've sort of started getting together a book of my own that I'm doing on giants from Britain. And it's clear that there was tribes of giants over here. It's
Yeah.
not just the giants. Do you know what I mean? We
Yeah.
had different tribes. And I mean, the book's got so much in it. You know, I could talk to you all night, Gary. It's fascinating. And like you've mentioned before, every time I talk to you, I do think about that film Highlander, because that seems to be, like you mentioned it, you know, there can be only one and they go around chopping heads off.
Yeah, it's the fairy tradition, so the patriarchal bloodline allegory, but it's talking about the same thing. So Tuatha De Danann, you see them as King Arthur and Guinevere. You know, Uther Pendragon is Arthur's father, and King Guinevere is a fairy queen. You know, of the Tuatha De Danann, and her meaning names goes back to, you know, basically a spirit or a shay.
Well, the original one of the interesting things about, because obviously the island of Britain separated into three countries now, but before all that, and before it was called Britain, which is named after Brutus from the Trojan Wars, it was called Albion. And Albion was a giant.
He
Well, there's
was.
two stories as to why it's called Albion. One is that Albion, he came over with his brother Bergeon, but it was named after Albion because he first came here and he was a giant. But there's also a story regarding Albina, and they believe that she was banished here with her sisters, and they ended up creating some more giants.
Yeah, I cover
But they're
some of
just
those off in
everywhere,
book
aren't
two.
they? Giants is ubiquitous, you know. And I
It
can't
is.
understand why. I mean, I've got people where I go to church because I'm within the Reformed tradition. So you can imagine that probably most, not all, but a lot of people take the Sethite view. And I just can't wrap my head around it, especially when you get, I remember an old pastor of mine saying from the pulpit, "Oh, I don't believe in literal giants." And you're like, "Well, hang on. I'm sorry, but how can you not? I mean, what do you think Goliath was?" And it even gives you his height in there. Do you know what I mean? There is some, obviously,
That's six
discussion
cubits and a
over.
span as a royal cubit is 11 feet 3 inches.
So, I mean, that's a giant, a literal one. I don't understand why.
Well,
The
it's
top
one of
and
the
bottom of
reasons.
it for me is they don't really believe in the supernatural, as far as I'm concerned. They can't do. I mean, because once you start
Only
discounting, you're
parts.
saying, "Oh, well, I don't believe in giants." Well, do you believe Jesus walked on water then? Do you believe he raised the dead? And
You know, the Bible is the most preternatural book ever written. And why there's this political correctness to, or whatever the theology that's entered into the modern church to say that we can only recognize certain aspects of the preternatural nature, the message you're sending to people is either the Bible is inaccurate, or the parts that we do celebrate isn't really literal either, and it's just an allegory, which is a polytheist belief.
Well, that's my thinking. It's like, where do you stop when you start saying, "Well, I don't believe this is literal and I don't believe that's literal." I mean, obviously I'm not talking about things where the Lord says, cut your hand off and pluck your eye out. We know that's not literal. That's figurative about if you're doing something you shouldn't be doing, stop doing it. If you're looking at something you shouldn't be looking at, stop looking at it. But when people start saying, "I don't believe in literal giants, I don't believe in this," it's like, like you've just said, we're sending the message out that the Bible's not accurate. Well, the Bible is accurate, and God says what he means and means what he says. And I've said as well to people that they say, "No, I don't believe in literal giants." I said, "Well, you know what? History and archaeology is against you. It's against them because the evidence, the data points to the fact that there were real giants."
So in book two, that's why I spent a lot of time in the first part of the book, and I do a number of things when I'm doing it, but one, I'm going to provide biblical arguments how we know these are giants, and then we're going to talk about all the different kinds of giants there are, and I'm going to tell you how you know biblically these are giants, so that people can take it away. And I will go into book two in ways that most people don't sort of go into it, so they because they want to know, well, how can a spirit being create a physical being? So I give you how that happens and do it through biblical terms and then give you examples of how we know they can take physical forms, which is all in the Bible, whether it's in Hebrews 13, where you might run across an angel unaware. So you better be nice to strangers, and or the physical nature of angels showing up with Jehovah, who also takes a physical form in this when he presents himself before Abraham, and then the two angels that go off to Sodom, they're in this physical form. And those are just some of, so we know they can take physical forms, and yet people don't sort of connect the dots on some of this. And I'm going to take, you know, I'll give you the arguments to show you how we know that when they're talking about the sons of God, they're not talking about Sethites. They're not talking about the new sons of God that are talked about in the New Testament, where we receive that, even though we have, as a title, we receive that as sons of God, even though we have human fathers through the resurrection. It's a prophecy to happen. We're going to be like angels in that time. And then I take on the argument about marriage in heaven as well as part of that. But if you want to understand who the sons of God in the Old Testament are, A, just let the Bible tell you. So when it says sons of God, that's the same sons of God in Jude 1:6 or 2:1 that present themselves in heaven. And to this day, we haven't done that. So it's not humans. But more importantly, in Job 38, 4-7, these are the sons of God who are celebrating with the morning stars at creation. Well, we certainly weren't there in creation. Now, there's terms that are used interchangeably in the Bible, which I walked through a couple of times here in book two for people. And I have a great document on this as well. If people want to get a hold of me, I have lots of good documents I send at no charge. So when you hear the word host, as I talked about, host of heaven, that's an army of angels, right? And so host is used interchangeably with stars, just as in Daniel 8, for example, where you have, you know, some of the host of heaven were thrown down, or some of the stars of the host of heaven were thrown down on the earth in the end time for Antichrist to trample on. You have angels and hosts. You have sons of God and morning stars. So you have star, host, angel, and sons of God that are used in various forms throughout the Old Testament together, all talking about angels. I mean, you have to reinvent what the Bible says to say that these sons of God are humans, and they're not Israel, where you get the children of God or the sons of God used in the Old Testament in terms of Israel. Again, that's the time of second Exodus. It's a prophecy down the road. It's not in the time before the flood. So I'll do that and a whole bunch of other things for Christians to say here. I'm not here to divide the church, but I don't think the Bible ever contradicts itself. Definitely. And I don't think that you should reinvent what the Bible says, and that I think the Bible is written for people to understand, not use through interpretive approach, which is the polytheist approach.
I mean, obviously, whether we believe in giants or we don't, it's not a salvation issue. But, you know, I think it's just important to clarify these things, because we need to defend the Bible. And if you start saying, you know, I don't believe this and I don't believe that, I think you're going down the slippery slope, in my opinion. Because you don't know. Yeah.
It's not a buffet.
Gary, it's been fascinating talking to you again. I mean, you're talking and I'm listening, my mind's racing because you've got that much information. It's, you know, I definitely tell people, listen, you've got to get Gary's books, because these podcast episodes are not doing it the justice that they deserve, because Gary spent years researching these books. So, just before we go, Gary, could you just remind people again about your website? And obviously, you've got the new book now released.
Yep. Yeah. And I'll just leave people with something. You know, when we talk about the giants, the Bible, you have to understand the table of nations And the patriarchs are they're listed and the patriarchs that aren't listed in there. So Rapha doesn't have a patriarch for the Rephaim, even though it shows up as a tribe in Genesis 14 and Genesis 15. You have Anakim, who are giants, as Deuteronomy 2 talks about, and they're talked about in that Numbers report in 13, chapter 13. Their patriarch is listed as Arba in the book of Joshua, but he's not in the Table of Nations. And these are Aboriginal peoples, as they're described. And so if we understand that patriarchs for hybrid giant nations, their names aren't in the Table of Nations, which is why you have the patriarchless nine nations of the Canaanites. And tribe patriarchs, founders of giant tribes, of the giants, aren't listed in the Table of Nations, starts to make sense of peoples that don't go back to the Table of Nations. And I'll just rattle through some of the names: the Hivim, the Hurim, the Horim, the Perizim, the Malachim, the Zuzim, Zamzim, Emim, Geshurim, Gerzim, Makathim, Avim, Kenazim, Kenim, Kadmonim, Cherethim, Kaphtorim, Casualim, Gibalim, and I think that's most of them. So if people are interested in having a closer look at my book, I have a generous excerpt of all 98 chapters in book one and all 84 chapters in book two. You don't have to read one to read the other, although one will lead you to want to read the other. And if you're a Christian, depending on how deep you are into the Bible, if you are familiar with the Bible and you want to go deep, that's book two. If you want to get the bigger picture, then you read book one, and then you'll want to go into book two, and vice versa. So I have a generous excerpt of all chapters, and it's just a small drop of what's in the book. And if you've not seen or read a book by me, it's loaded with information. It's a long book. Each chapter is written as a mini story that leads into the next chapter, and will keep coming up as the book unfolds. And so you can read an average chapter. It'll be, you know, 5 pages, 4 to 5 pages. So I keep it short with a mini story. You can read as you want and come back as you like, or jump forward and come back. All is fine in reading of the book. So that's all on my website. And on my website, you can get a signed copy of book one or book two, and you go to the buy now page, book one or book two. And on that buy now page, there's a US page, there's a Canadian page, and then there's an international page. So if you're not in the US or Canada with those separate pages, you go to the international page, and I ship my books all over the world from my website, and you can get a signed copy that way. And if you wanted to link over to barnesandnoble.com or amazon.com or amazon.ca, I don't have .au on their connections or .uk on there, but you can link over to Amazon, and the books are on Amazon. You can buy them there. But there are links for both versions, for the Kindle version. And so those, you can get that through Amazon as well, and link through from my website. And if you wanted to contact me, there's a contact the author. And that's my email, website email address. If you just click on that, write your message, it'll come through to me, or use the direct Genesis6conspiracy@gmail.com. So again, the number 6, just as with the website. And it may take me a month to get back to you, but I will get back to you. The printed copy for book two, still not available in Canada, still not available except in the US. I think they're trying to catch up with demand on that. So hopefully those books will be available in the printed copy soon, but certainly the book one is available through the various Amazon sites around the world in a printed version.
Yeah. If you're international guys like me, easiest way is obviously Kindle. And it's a good book for Kindle. But if you want it instantly, you can get it, you know, straight away on that. So thanks again, Gary. It's been brilliant again talking to you. I'm sure people are going to love this episode, as they have done the first one that we've done. I'll be back next week, guys, with another guest. I'm Paul, and this is Beyond the Paradigm.
Am I crazy? We don't use that word in here.